Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, did your brain make you do it? Or maybe it was your genetics. Scientists are finding more and more evidence that human behavior is not rational. Then, what is the role of emotion in determining the fate of our nation? Then, our culture of excess. A psychologist talks about how America lost self-control and why we need to redefine success. Scientists are finding more and more evidence that human behavior is not rational, not conscious, and may be completely programmed without our rational thinking. That's the subject of two books. The first one is called The Hidden Brain: How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. And we also have another book called Red Genes, Blue Genes: Exposing Political Irrationality. We've got both authors with us. Shankar Vedantam is an award-winning science reporter at The Washington Post and a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. He's written The Hidden Brain. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Maria. Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. We also have with us Guillermo Jimenez. He's a professor of international trade at the State University of New York, and he's the author of Red Genes, Blue Genes. Welcome, Guillermo.
Hi, Maria. Great to be here. I'm a big fan of Shankar's.
Oh, good. Well, it's good to have a little mutual love fest going on the air. So, you know, I was thinking that the way we could perhaps go about this, because you're both talking about an irrationality, but you're approaching it slightly from different places. So why don't we start with Shankar and your findings? You open, actually, with this story of a rape victim and how she misidentifies a rapist, but she's certain that this was him. She's memorized all these parts of his face and his body so she can report it to the police. And then she made a mistake. The jury made a mistake. He spent 13 years in prison. And you say this was an unconscious thing that happened to her that was partly determined by her mood and emotions and other unconscious things. Explain that.
Well, this is a really tragic story, Maria, involving a woman called Toni Custis, who was raped in Massachusetts about two decades ago. And what distinguished her, I think, is that she was a remarkably conscientious eyewitness. She took great pains during the crime to memorize the features of the man who was committing the crime. But over the course of the next weeks and months, as police showed her many, many images of people whom they thought might be potential suspects, and then eventually the person whom they thought was the suspect who had committed the crime, her memory of the case degraded to some extent. And she was pretty sure the police had the right person, but there was a little bit of a doubt at the back of her mind. And she spent that Christmas with her family at a church that had long been a source of comfort and solace for her. And while sitting in the church, her doubts slipped away, and she told herself that she had gotten the man, that it was the person who had raped her. As it turned out, a DNA test conducted about a decade later showed that this man could not have been the criminal. And it prompted Toni Custis to go through a very lengthy period of recrimination and wondering how she could have made the error she made. The point that I was trying to make in this chapter and that I make throughout The Hidden Brain is that we regularly think that people's intentions are decisive, that if someone means to be a good eyewitness or a good juror or a good judge or a good politician, that they are a good juror, judge, or politician. It turns out that there is much in our lives that lies outside the boundaries of our conscious awareness. And in this church where Toni Custis's doubts slipped away, in some ways, I make the argument that reassurance and solace were not her friends in this situation. Her doubt that was at the back of her mind was actually her friend, because it was telling her something is not quite right.
What had happened, in particular with this, there were all these emotions that had come into place and that had her really make a misjudgment.
I think that's right. And the ironic thing in this case was that she was someone who had been through a traumatic event, and you can see why it would be most understandable for her to seek a situation where she was comforted and had some solace from the situation. But she was also in a position where she was being asked to make a very difficult judgment. And the point that I was trying to make in this chapter is, without her intending to make a mistake, in fact, with her intending to do things exactly right, and she was a really conscientious, diligent person, and someone whom I respect and regard very, very highly. She yet made this mistake. And the point that I was trying to make is if this mistake can happen to Toni Gustavs, it can happen to any of us.
Right. Now, you have talked about some other really important phenomena that deal with race, with gender, and even when people are conscientiously trying not to have that be an issue, how they are still programmed, in essence.
Indeed. I think the, much of the book that that I've written looks at the question of the unconscious very broadly. It's sort of how we make unconscious bias affects our romantic decisions, our financial decisions, our moral decisions, our political decisions. And one of the domains that I explore at some length is the question of unconscious prejudice. There has been a really explosion of research in the last 10 or 20 years looking at unconscious prejudice, how to measure it, what effects it has. And the striking thing again here is that, you know, we pay a lot of attention to hate crimes or people who explicitly say racist things or sexist things. But it turns out that at an unconscious level, prejudice exists in very, very, very large numbers of people, perhaps even among most people. And these effects are subtle. They're not sort of the person who is, you know, burning a cross on someone else's lawn. This is a person who may have an unconscious association in their heads. But when they are asked to make a decision about whether somebody is guilty or innocent of a crime or whether to hire someone for a job, these unconscious associations play very powerful roles, especially because most people do not believe the unconscious exists. And so we have no way to guard against the manipulation because we don't even realize that we are being manipulated.
I thought one of the most convincing parts of your book was dealing with gender bias, and the only way they could really measure it was with transgendered people. And so here you had, for example, somebody who transgendered from a woman to a man, and suddenly same person, same qualifications, same education, and the income went up. And right. The interruption stopped.
That's right. So the challenge I was trying to explore in this chapter is that there is abundant research showing that on average, women are not paid the same as men. They face all kinds of challenges compared to men. But when you're asked to make a judgment about any individual person, say Hillary Clinton in the 2008 presidential election, it's very difficult to apply the general research on bias to an individual because in any individual circumstance, there are many other factors. You know, how good a candidate is Hillary Clinton? What are her positions on the issues? What's the competition like? And so on. But then I realized that there was a group of people who, in effect, could become their own control groups. And these were people who were transgendered. And I found remarkably that there was research showing that when men transition to being women, their hourly salaries drop, and often drop quite dramatically. When women transition to being men, their hourly salaries on average rise. But the real effects of sexism are actually much more subtle than just a question of salary. Men who become women experience losses of all kinds of privileges that they didn't know they had. And women who become men experience sort of the relief in some ways of being carried by a current that they didn't even know existed. And that's stronger than them in some ways. So it's a disturbing chapter in many ways. But the transgendered, who themselves, of course, face many challenges because they are transgendered, offer us a very, very powerful and insightful window into the nature of sexism in the United States.
There's one other phenomenon I want to have you talk about before we bring Guillermo back in, and that is this chapter that opened with the fate of a young woman, Delitha Word, and how she was essentially tortured and beaten to her death among a crowd of people who stood there aghast of what was happening, but nobody took action. You said that if one person would have taken action, perhaps the whole crowd would have moved. Talk about that phenomenon.
Well, I think this phenomenon actually has been widely described for a very long period of time. It's called the bystander effect in psychology, and there have been many cases like this, the Kitty Genovese case in New York some years ago, for example, showing that often when terrible things unfold, we intuitively believe that it's a good thing to have many people around. Because if there are many people, then surely there will be some good Samaritans among them. It turns out that the opposite is true, that you're more likely to have people come to your aid and assistance when there are a few people rather than many people. The insight that I've tried to bring to this chapter is to try and show that the bystander effect doesn't just affect our ability to act in the service of other people. It affects our ability to act in the service of ourselves. And I try and show that in disaster settings, when we are when we receive an ambiguous warning of disaster, the same thing happens when we are confronted by somebody else who is in danger. When we're surrounded by large groups of people, in some ways, groups rob us of our autonomy and our ability to act in intentional ways. And there is very compelling research showing that these forces played a very large role in the events that unfolded on the morning of September 11, 2001, in the South Tower of the World Trade Center in particular.
And the South Tower in particular because?
Well, the South Tower was the second tower to be hit that awful morning, and there was a 16-minute window between when the first tower was hit and the second tower was hit. And a substantial part of this chapter talks about a financial trading firm that was spread over the 88th and 89th floor of the South Tower. And after the rubble had cleared, I showed that nearly everyone on one floor had escaped the building and survived, whereas nearly everyone on the other floor stayed behind in their building and stayed behind at their desks and perished. And my point was not so much that one group made the right decision and one group made the wrong decision. We know, of course, the group that left was making the right decision, but we know that in hindsight. The point that I'm trying to make is that in crises, people tend to act together. People are either silent together or they act together. They either intervene together or they're passive together. They either flee together or they stay at their desks together. Groups rob us of our autonomy when crises break out. And this is something that has a great deal of consequence, not just for our ability to act in moral ways, but for our ability to protect ourselves and those we love in times of disaster.
Well, perhaps now we can bring Guillermo Jimenez back in.
Yeah.
Now, you wrote Red Jeans, Blue Jeans, Exposing Political Irrationality. You actually bring an extra element into this, which has to do with kind of the genetic part of people, kind of a biological predisposition towards political outcomes.
Right. One of the arguments that I make in the book is that all of us are born, not all of us, but most of us are born somewhere along with a left-to-right political disposition. And that influences our political orientation throughout our lives in kind of the unconscious and unperceived way that Shankar was talking about. And so the great majority of us do have some political bias that we're guilty of, but we tend to not perceive it because it lies in the unconscious, and we have a lot of techniques of self-deception to prevent that from rising to our consciousness. But we perceive it very well in the other party. And that's one of the funny things about irrationality, is that we can see it in others but not in ourselves. And recently, myself, I've been marveling at TV commentator Glenn Beck, who for me is kind of almost the incarnation of political irrationality from the from a liberal perspective. I think it's hard for a liberal to watch Glenn Beck without coming to the conclusion after a while that the man is kind of unhinged. And he's so obviously biased that anything that Obama does or that the Democratic administration does, he's going to criticize. He's going to come in against it. And he doesn't perceive that bias, but we as liberals do. On the other hand, I think, you know, the insight that I propose in this book is that as liberals, we are not immune to this kind of irrationality. I mean, we've got Blagojevich, we've got David Paterson, we have our guilty parties as well. And in a very similar way to the way that Republicans or conservatives view politics from a biased perspective, we do as well.
This way that you opened your book, you talked about how you were watching Orrin Hatch, and from every fiber of your being, everything that you saw, heard, the way he wore his hair, the way he wore his tie, the way he spoke, his accent, everything made you recoil. You said, in essence, his DNA really upset your DNA. And you said that this is especially now prevalent on both sides, and that this political irrationality is driven by a number of phenomena. I think partly you're saying there's a genetic base to it, but I think Shankar's piece also here and some of the research you brought in terms of groups and in terms of emotions. And the question I think I'm trying to get to is, how much of it is this media blitz that we're getting on both sides? And we've all read the works of Cass Sunstein. And how much of it is really a distinction between them? Guillermo, why don't you start, and then let's see what Shankar has to say.
Well, research that I cite that's very interesting, there's a professor named John Hibbing out at the University of Nebraska that's done some just incredible groundbreaking research in the field of the biological bases of our political dispositions. I'll just mention, you know, very briefly, one of his experiments got a group of people that he had categorized previously through questionnaires as very liberal or very conservative. And he exposed them to these startling stimuli, like loud noises, gruesome photographs, and then he measured their involuntary responses. And what he found is the people that were more instinctively fearful, that corresponded with conservative political orientation. In other words, those people were more likely to support defense spending, the Iraq war, capital punishment, patriotism, whereas the people that showed a calmer or less fearful instinctive response were more likely to support pacifism, liberal immigration policies, foreign aid, and so forth. And what that suggests is that there is a biological component, which may be slight or may be slender, but is definitely present and detectable in our political opinions. And what's kind of shocking to us about that is that we don't perceive it ourselves. You know, we think that we come to all of our political opinions through some exercise of logic or reason. And I argue that it's about 50% genetics. But what's even more concerning is that on top of that genetic layer, we also have a cultural layer which also reinforces biases and prejudices. So most of us end up doubly prejudiced or biased in our politics, partially our biological inheritance and partially from our social upbringing.
Shankar, what would you add?
Well, I certainly think Dr. Jimenez is right in terms of the idea that I think there are certain biological predispositions to political orientation. The thing that I find fascinating about our divide is twofold. One, why is it so much more intense today than it was, say, 50 years or 100 years ago? You know, our biology hasn't changed, but if you look at the number of Democrats who are passionately against a Republican president and vice versa, the gap is just extraordinary today compared to where it was 100 years ago. And the other thing that I find really intriguing, and this is really in some ways a puzzle to me, is when you look at many of the issues that divide liberals and conservatives, they don't fall along what you would call logical patterns. So, for example, conservatives are against government intervention in general, and they want sort of a hands-off, laissez-faire policy. But when it comes to abortion or family values issues, they want a very interventionist government policy. They want sort of government to be involved in sort of running people's lives or telling people, here's what's appropriate and here's what's inappropriate. The striking thing here is not, I'm not trying to point out necessarily that one side is being hypocritical, because I think Guillermo is right in terms of saying that both sides are guilty of this. The interesting thing is why it is that people don't see these inconsistencies themselves, that when you're on one side, there's nothing that your side can do that feels wrong, and there's nothing that the other side that can do that feels right. And I've seen some very interesting research from political science that argues that in many ways, the driver behind partisanship is sort of the same driver that's behind our passion for our sports teams. So, you know, I'm a Philadelphia Eagles fan, and when I think about it, it's absurd to be a fan of any single football team, because these are players who are interchangeably going between the different teams. They just happen to be wearing one set of colors. But when I'm on the, you know, when I'm watching a game, my team can do no wrong, and every ambiguous call of the referees make, I sort of say, well, you know, they made a mistake and they should have given it to the Eagles. And I think the same thing is happening at the political level as well, that we sort of identify with either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party in the same way we identify with sports teams, and that in some ways causes us to fail to see the inconsistencies of our own positions and fail to see the weaknesses in our own side or any good in the other side.
You know, there was some research done a while back in political psychology that showed that membership of a group, even if it's completely arbitrary,
right,
automatically creates an us and a them and creates competition. Perhaps that's a missing element, and that's the thing that needs to be understood. Guillermo, you actually also talked about this phenomenon. What do you have to say?
I think the example or the symbol of the sporting contest is a great one, and was actually used in a lot of the psychology research. You know, students are assigned to watch a basketball game, and they're randomly assigned to one or the other team. And what we discover is within minutes, they become very biased in favor of that team. And that is quite similar, I think, Shankar is right, to the bias that we exhibit on behalf of our political parties. But I would say to his point, you know, why is it increasing? Why are we perceiving it to be such a problem these days? Well, there are a number of reasons. The first thing I would say is there are some political scientists at Princeton, Nolan McCarty and Keith Poole, who wrote a book called Polarized America a couple of years ago, that studied the history of polarization in the Congress, and they found that polarization in Congress increases in times of economic stress. And when we are trying to rewrite our fundamental social contracts, it kind of makes sense that we'll get more polarized. We've got health care reform. It's going to change our country. And so when things like that are on the table, it's kind of natural that you'll have some polarization. But on top of that, you have the phenomena of the modern media and the internet. One thing that Cass Sunstein says, you know, Maria mentioned earlier, is that nowadays, you know, we can get all of our information from biased news sources. And a lot of people do. I mean, there's a lot of people that, you know, watch Fox News, and then they read the Wall Street Journal, and they read Ann Coulter's books, and they're not going to get a very fair and balanced view of reality that way. And then finally, on top of that, you add the modern media circus, which makes money from this conflict. And, you know, the great example is our political presidential campaigns, where all of the media giants just run political shows all day long. And how do they get eyeballs to those shows? It's by presenting us figures like Sarah Palin and divisive figures that rile up our emotions and get our eyeballs glued to those TVs. So, you know, we have a number of factors working together which have given us kind of this perfect storm of polarization that we're now in.
I'd actually like to also bring in, since you're talking about media, the issues of fear and loathing, which you say are the most dangerous parts of political irrationality. Guillermo?
Yeah, well, I think we need to fear political irrationality. I think the insight I want to get across in my book is that we have to examine it in ourselves, and we have to be wary of political appeals to fear and to hatred. And I think, you know, on the liberal side, you know, I feel that right now we don't have a lot of appeals to hatred. Maybe we did during the Bush era. There were liberal, a lot of liberals hated George Bush. Now, I think the problem, you know, on the liberal side is that not only on the liberal side, but on both sides, our politicians attract our attention by creating fear in us. And liberals, unfortunately, can be as guilty of this as conservatives. You know, conservatives present a frightening picture of liberal statists who want to, you know, control your very life. And liberals present this counterportrait of, you know, hateful, racist, corporate, warmongering conservatives. And the result is not a happy one for our political environment in general.
You know, that reminds me of something that Shankar wrote about, which was about terrorism and extremism and how there is no real psychological profile that's different between a suicide bomber and somebody else. What does this mean to us, Shankar?
Well, this was a chapter that looks specifically at sort of extreme behavior. And I try to make the argument, Maria, that even though it seems as if that terrorists come from dysfunctional backgrounds or dysfunctional personalities, there has been systematic research conducted among people who attempted to be suicide bombers, their missions failed, and now they're in prisons all over the world. And the research into these people shows that they are hardly more aberrational than the rest of us. In many ways, they may suffer from fewer mental illnesses. They seem to be more idealistic than the rest of us. And nor is it the case that they're particularly more religious than the rest of us. And I found this particularly striking. If you look at the history of suicide terrorism, actually, religion turns out to be neither necessary nor sufficient as an explanatory factor for suicide terrorism. What is common to suicide terrorism in different eras, from the Japanese kamikaze bombers in the closing days of World War II to the Sri Lankan Tamil Tigers in the 1980s to, you know, the various suicide terrorist outfits today, is that suicide terrorists typically are formed in an environment where they're essentially cut off from the outside world for a variety of reasons. And in our normal lives, most of us get pulled in different directions. You know, we have ties to our families and to our churches and religions and sports teams and professions, and, you know, this creates stress in our lives. But for the suicide bomber goes into what I call the tunnel. And within the tunnel, the person doesn't face the conflicts of the outside world. All of the reference points within the tunnel are the reference points created by people within the own group. And when you have this, what you have is a dynamic called small group psychology that takes over. And one of the things that small group psychology can accomplish is it can change the norms of what's good and bad behavior. So what seems aberrational to us outside the tunnel can become aspirational to the people within the tunnel. And so when we ask, why do suicide bombers do this aberrational thing, what we're not really taking into account is that we're standing outside the tunnel. We're not seeing how the norms have been systematically turned upside down within the tunnel, that is the suicide bombers' framework.
And that, of course, is very much like Zimbardo has taught us in terms of the what he calls the Lucifer effect. And I think that would bring us also, Guillermo Jimenez, you talk about these entire histories that are completely different from left and from right and what ends up taking us to war. And maybe this is what we're going to end on. Talk about taking us to war and how the left and the right see this in opposites.
Right. Well, probably the most eminent scientist in this whole field of bias is a man at Princeton, Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize in 2002. And he developed the whole modern theory of cognitive bias. Why are we biased? Why do we come to wrong perceptions, wrong conclusions? And he applied these theories to modern conduct of war in an article called Why Hawks Win. And what he observed was that, you know, most of the cognitive biases that we've discovered in the past 40 years tend to favor sort of a militaristic, warlike approach. And that if we examine the conduct of leaders in as we lead up to war, we find a lot of impact of the most common and cognitive biases that humans are subject to. I think probably the classic example is the Iraq War, and one of the most common biases that plagues human beings is our overconfidence bias. Human beings are tremendously overconfident, and the great example there was Vice President Cheney predicting that the American soldiers would be welcomed in Iraq as liberators. And, you know, anybody who's read what's going on in Iraq knows that that was never the case. So that's just one example of how our biases expose our leaders to go to war.
Guillermo Jimenez, thank you so much. Shankar Vedantam, thank you so much for being with us. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. What is the role of emotions in determining the fate of our nation or even our planet? Our next guest says a lot. Feelings, he says, are the basis of most political decisions, particularly voting decisions. Drew Weston is a psychologist and a professor at Emory University. His book is called The Political Brain, The Role of Emotions in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. Welcome, Drew Weston.
Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you here. So let's start with this brain scan that you and your colleagues did of 30 partisan voters to try to understand how they made decisions. Tell us about the process and what you found.
Well, what we were interested in was what happens if you present partisans with threatening information about their own candidates. So this was during the 2004 election, right in the middle of a time when it was the most heated, when George W. Bush was running against John Kerry. And we had partisans lie in the scanner, and we scanned their brains as they were first presented with some statement from the candidate, and then another statement that was completely contradicting it. And then we asked them to think about whether or not there's a contradiction and then to rate whether or not there was one. And the first finding is just without the scans was that our partisans didn't disappoint us. They twisted reality by and large until they believed what they wanted to believe.
So what you're saying is that they, what did they make up information? How did they twist it?
Well, basically they did what we all do and what you can watch on the if you watch the shows that have partisans talking to each other and at each other on television on Sunday mornings or any other time, they listened to the information in a way that they just kept twisting it and turning the cognitive kaleidoscope until it showed the pattern that they wanted to see.
So you did this with George Bush, you did it with John Kerry, but you also did it with neutral candidates.
Yes, we also did it with a neutral figure like Tom Hanks or Henry Aaron. As a scientist, I was delighted by the findings. As a partisan, I was kind of hoping I'd find the Fox News circuits of the brain that are responsible for distorting information. But that wasn't what happened. What we found was the Democrats and Republicans' brains looked really exactly alike. They were just mirror images of each other, where what got activated when people were taking a look at the contradiction and were seeing a slide of something that completely contradicted what they wanted to believe about their candidate, their brains were showing activation in distress areas, in areas that register conflict, and in areas of the brain involved in trying to get out of an unpleasant emotional feeling. And what we didn't see was activation in the reasoning circuits of the brain that are supposed to be the ones that we're using during politics when confronted with new information. So the thinking cap essentially didn't go on, the feeling cap did. And at the end of the whole process, once they had come to biased conclusions, they actually got a big jolt of reward, some dopamine circuits that are involved in making people feel good. So at the end of it, they ended up, after hearing bad, threatening information about their candidate, they ended up feeling even better about their candidate.
That's really interesting. It almost sounds a little bit parallel to a segment we did a while back about system justification theory. I don't know if you followed what that is. But people who are most hurt by the system are the ones that support it the most.
I wouldn't be surprised if the same processes are active, the same brain regions. And my guess is that they're probably the same ones that are active when you're defensively responding to almost anything, you know, where you feel bad about something you did, so you convince yourself it really wasn't so bad. My guess is a lot of those circuits in the brain are probably the same ones.
And what's also interesting is it sounds like there was an actual physical process that was going on in the brain where they're getting their dopamine, as you mentioned, so they're getting a fix.
That's exactly right. So if you ever wondered about the idea of political junkies, now you know it's actually true.
Right. Now, you went with subjects who were very politically aware. You didn't use subjects who were not necessarily politically aware, and you didn't go much to folks that were in the middle. Is that right?
That's right. We would have liked to include people who were nonpartisan, but by the time that we were doing the study, which was August, September, October of 2004, the election was already so polarized that if we wanted to find voters who weren't leaning Democratic or leaning Republican at that point, we probably would have had to go into neurology wards to find brain-damaged people. So we decided that we wanted to study normal people's voting behavior rather than neurology patients. So it would have been at that point too difficult to find anybody who had a normal brain who wasn't really leaning one direction or the other.
So ultimately, one of your conclusions is really there is no changing people who feel strongly attached to a particular party or a particular ideology.
Right. I mean, if you look at it historically, I mean, there is change that can happen, but it tends to happen slowly. So that, for example, for some people on some things, there's no changing at all. 30% of Americans still believe that Joe McCarthy was a hero after he was disgraced when he was finally investigated by his own Senate in the 1950s. And you know, for people who remember that, who have seen newsreels of it, you can't get more disgrace than he got, and 30% still thought he was great. You have to be pushing the envelope pretty far to believe that. It looks like that there's about 30% on the far left and 30% on the far right for whom data make very, very little difference. And the striking thing that comes from, if you read a lot of other research in psychology and neuroscience and political science, is that, I mean, one of our conclusions was that the political brain is an emotional brain. It's not a dispassionate calculator. But if you look at what happens with those people in the middle, the same is true of them, too. They don't primarily respond to rational arguments. They're not as biased in the same way as partisans, but they react emotionally just as partisans do.
And this is where you brought up the issue of truthiness.
Exactly. The other, you know, where the book really leads after, you know, starting with this whole brain study is into the whole idea of, is there a difference between the parties, not in the way our brains function, because it's clear that Democrats and Republicans are both quite capable of distorting reality until it makes them feel comfortable. But the question really that the book addresses then is, well, is there a difference between the way that Democrats and Republicans appeal to the brain? And that's where there are huge differences that have to do, I think, with why Republicans have had only one candidate for the presidency in, I think, since Herbert Hoover, actually, who was elected and not reelected. And Democrats have only had one since FDR, who was elected and reelected.
Now, I wonder if this is also why there's such a strong adherence to shows like Rush Limbaugh or Fox News so that people in that 30% can avoid conflicting information.
Well, that's right. And it's one of the dangerous things about shows like that is that they really do, they confirm realities. They make you feel better at the end of them. You know, they're great for a feeling of solidarity with people who feel similar to you, but they're not terribly good for a democracy because if at the end of watching years of Fox News, as it's now clear, most people who've done that believe that Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein were brothers in crime, then you've got a real problem.
The other thing that you brought up was that, you know, Republicans really have been masters at manipulating the emotions. And I think you said they have a near monopoly in the marketplace of emotions. I think that was your quote. They've gotten government off our backs. They've saved the flag. They've left no child behind. They've kept marriage sacred. And yet, when you look at the left, whether it's the Democrats or the Greens, they have not really been able to tap into that emotion.
That's right. And you know, it can, what's a manipulation and what's simply good, you know, good advertising or offering an emotionally compelling argument, the line between those can get pretty difficult to tell. You know, Frank Luntz, who's the brilliant wordsmith on the right, most of the time I think his work is just brilliant. I mean, I think the idea of taking something like a boring old estate tax and turning it into a death tax, which makes you immediately think, well, wait a minute, that's not fair. Taxing you for dying? You know, that's a natural extension of it. I don't think that is a manipulative appeal. I think it's just an extremely good one.
Well, some of them are directly, I would say, misleading. No Child Left Behind, you know, the Clean Forest, or what was it called?
The Clear Skies.
Clear Skies, right.
That's right. That's one where, you know, what I talk about in the book is how Democrats can emulate the way Republicans use language and imagery when they do it ethically, but they should not do it in the kind of misleading ways that have been done with, you know, having the leading polluters in the country write the air legislation and then call it the Clear Skies Initiative. That's crossing a line of ethics that I don't think anybody should cross.
But what you are saying is that appealing to people's sense of reason does not work.
That's right. If you appeal only to the reason, you give the kind of appeals the Democrats have tried to rely on for years. So what you'll see Democrats do all the time is to say, you know, I'm going to tell you my 16-point energy plan. And they'll, you know, essentially rattle off the points in their plan. You can hear our candidates sometimes in debates say, here's my response to that. 1, 2, 3, 4, A, B, C. And, you know, that's really effective if you're debating at, you know, a Georgetown College debate tournament. But the average American does not respond to that style well, because what the average American's really looking for are, and the data all from about 50 years of presidential elections show this, is that the way most voters choose their candidates is the first biggest impact on them is what do they feel about the parties and their principles, and the second is what do they feel about the candidate. And it goes way down the list before you get to what do they feel about particular issues, and it's off the charts so far down the list of what facts and figures you believe about the particular issues. And what that means is that if you do what Democrats do, which is that you think that it's all a debate about the issues and you focus on, let me tell you my plan and how it differs from his plan, and you list all the points, voters essentially get bored, they shut you out, and then the other side says something catchy, and particularly something that has some kind of moral meaning attached to it. And immediately the voter's mind is drawn to the one who's given an emotionally compelling argument rather than a rational argument.
Would you say that decision makers at the level of Congress or in the courts, and you did talk a little bit about this in your book, but not in as much length as you did about average voters, do you think that those decision makers are equally as emotionally based in their decisions as are average voters?
Yes. In fact, if you looked at we actually did a study during the impeachment trial of Bill Clinton where we were trying to predict how the average person was making decisions.
You
on
mean
that.
The average person or the congressman?
Well, the particular study was with average people, and what we found with average people is that they looked exactly like the congressman, which is the congressman said, well, you know, I read the 30,000 pages of documents on this, and I studied the data, and I voted my conscience, and this is what I came up with. And it just so happened that all the Republicans voted one way and all the Democrats voted the other way. It was just the same thing in Bush v. Gore that decided the presidential election in 2000, where Clarence Thomas whether just out of complete ignorance or disingenuousness, you know, was imploring people
to believe.
Or both, probably some combination of the two. His brain was, I suspect, showing the same patterns that we found in our scans in 2004. You know, he insisted that, you know, when we put on those judicial robes, all of our partisan baggage disappears. That's a phenomenally naive argument when a court decision
or a well-crafted argument.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I mean, it was obviously an attempt to legitimize a decision that, you know, virtually every legal scholar who's looked at that decision has said that it makes no sense whatsoever. Among other things, they said, don't consider this a precedent. Well, you know, when you're the Supreme Court, you can't just make a decision on the basis of one case and say, but never follow this again. I mean, that's just not how Supreme Court decisions are made.
There have been some studies that show that some emotions are stronger in terms of responding to one's appeal. One is fear. The other is hatred. And these have been studied in terms of genocides and how it's used to get people to kill their neighbors. And particularly in Rwanda, we saw this get people to hate a particular group, whether they happen to be immigrants or whatever, but also fear, you know, being afraid of these groups. I'm wondering, because when you look at strategists, particularly the Republicans, they seem to be the master of using hatred and fear. Can you talk to that a bit?
Yes, they are, and they get away with it because Democrats never call them on it. I mean, I can't remember the last time. I'll give you an example. When the immigration, quote-unquote, debate began, and it was in the middle of an election season, you know, illegal immigrants had been coming over the border for years, including years since 9/11, and the Republicans hadn't made anything of it. Well, suddenly then, you know, immigration became a major issue. Our borders aren't protected became a major issue. And the Democrats responded by essentially saying, oh, we better come up with our immigration bill. And, you know, had I been advising the Democrats at that time, I would have simply advised them to say to the Republicans, what's the matter? Gays aren't working for you this year?
Right.
Because it would have called hate by its proper name. And one of the things that I talk about a good bit in the book is how if you call hate by its proper name, people figure it out. If you don't, you can incite them to hatred.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Drew Weston, for being with us.
Thanks very much.
Drew Weston,
for having me on.
He's a psychologist and a professor. He teaches at Emory University, and his book is called The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Insiders, offering insight into today's most pressing issues, and I'm your host, Maria Armudian. America has entered the age of excess, according to our next guest. Driven by a maddening quest for perfection, technology, deregulation, and a superficial and often inaccurate mass media, our national psychology has become increasingly narcissistic, he says. That is leading to a culture of cheating, lying, reckless behavior, which has crashed the economy and continues to wreck lives in the national fabric. The emerging nation of narcissists has more consequences should the spiral continue, making a world that accepts cheating and lying as a way of life. Jay Slosar is a psychologist, professor of psychology, and author of The Culture of Excess, How America Lost Self-Control, and Why We Need to Redefine Success. Welcome, Jay Slosar.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
Why don't we start with you're a psychologist, and not all of our listeners are, so perhaps we can start with a definition of narcissism, and what are the characteristics of this?
Right. Well, it is, in the formal sense, in our diagnostic and statistical manual, it has features for a full-blown diagnosis. I present a continuum in my book that the symptoms are increasing, the aspects of it. And the features include a sense of entitlement, grandiosity, high expectations, a sense of immediacy. With that comes some undesirable features also, such as having less empathy for others and being less forgiving. And while that could lead to a lot of drive and possibly in the workplace, many of our successful people, it's been written for a long time by psychology that many of our CEOs are very top people who reach top spots have high narcissistic features. Of course, there's a downside to it also. And if it's increasing across the culture, kind of like the water level's rising and we have more of these narcissistic features without being fully aware of it.
Well, let's start with the evidence that we're seeing an increase of this kind of person in society. What are we seeing?
Well, the forces that I talk a lot about are the impacting this, the technology and technology and meeting extreme capitalism. And we see excess everywhere. Now, there's a technical debate on measuring these narcissistic traits over generations because it is a difficult research endeavor. One researcher has, in her book, Generation Me, has put forth that the scores on the narcissistic personality inventory have increased a good 20 to 30% in today's college students from previous generations. So that the features that we're seeing, we're just hit with them every day, from the excess in purchasing and material things, even lack of self-control and obesity, budgets, whether it's state, federal, our individual budgets, just the stuff everyone, you know, is accumulating. We use a lot of medications. There's tremendous waste everywhere, as in healthcare. Even in prison, we put more people in prison than any other nation does. I mean, we just have excess everywhere from a declining self-control fueled by these higher narcissistic features that make us more impulsive and more entitled.
So you really do think that a lot of what is underlying, I should say, societal ills are really a result of kind of a growing narcissism?
Yes, but it's a cultural phenomenon. What I talk about is that not everybody has a narcissistic personality disorder. It's more a reaction and a response to powerful cultural forces. At one point, I even say, you know, culture trumps personality, that these powerful cultural forces are pushing us in this direction. You know, the quick speed of technology where everything is just so immediate, and combine that with media and have that 24/7 cycle, and then the third feature, the extreme capitalism that has gone on with so much risk. And I put forth that those forces are cumulative and interactive in how they're influencing our personalities.
How these issues like deregulation and like the technology and the high speed, how do they actually interact with human beings in order to make them more impulsive and more narcissistic, and some other things that you talked about in the book, the anxiety, the expectations of immediacy, losing of patience, the overweightness and the addictions? How does it feed in? I mean, what's the process?
Well, the basic point is that it doesn't apply limits or boundaries. You know, for example, with the deregulation and those aspects, it throws it wide open and anything goes until our behavior rages out of control. In other words, you know, kind of on a continuum, you may be healthy, but then these pressures and lack of boundaries and regulations cause you to go over the top and even possibly commit an illegal activity. A lot of the people arrested for some of these activities were not bad people. You know, they hadn't been criminals before, but they got caught up in the cultural forces where the top is kind of lifted off, and then eventually we take more risk and with less self-control, overdo it in all of the many areas and get into difficulties or health problems.
You know, one of the things that struck me is the bit about cheating and how much young people, students, are cheating and admitting to it and lying and believing that they have to cheat and lie in order to succeed in society.
Right.
And I wonder if, in fact, that is the phenomenon more than anything else. Is this
kind
of...
Well, that certainly is, as I put it, where it's at in terms of the psychological conflict. You know, in the chapter where I cite a lot of the data on surveys of teens and young people who, you know, have to admit that to get ahead, to do well, to be successful, they've got to be manipulative and lie at times. Yet, when asked about their own character, they rate it very, very highly. So, in other words, my character is terrific and great, but on a day-to-day basis, I do have to manipulate, lie, cheat, and steal to survive. survive and to make it. So, you know, that seems like such an obvious conflict, but that's kind of the way culture in the world is. Now, there's probably always been that way to some extent. What I'm kind of saying is that, you know, like that water level again, it's just getting worse and worse to the point where it really does affect your sense of self. If I'm walking around and saying that I'm, you know, I'm great, I'm terrific, and this and that, yet in fact my behavior doesn't match that, well, that's quite a conflict.
Yeah, I think the question that really is raised, and you played with it in your book in this chapter about the cheating, deals with how does a person maintain ethics and character and still be successful in today's business environment or in today's political environment?
That's right.
How do we answer that?
It gets down to real strength of character and leadership skills, you know, to stand out, the ability to withstand the big waves going, you know, and stand up and go against.
But as you said, culture trumps personality.
Yeah, it's very, very hard at this point. And it really does take, I think, a fuller awareness of it and some kind of hitting the bottom point where you say, wait a minute, enough already, and you start to take a more declarative, direct position and realize the kind of big wave that's sweeping over you and pull yourself out of it. Of course, some people are jolted out of that after they get into trouble or after they are exposed, so to speak. And then they pull themselves out of that. We've had so much of that. Well, I'm hoping that we'll hit that point and people will, you know, turn around in the same way that when we had the Great Recession, it forced people to start saving money. Our savings rate for people was like 1 or 2%, you know, far less than other nations. And in 2007, it actually went below zero. It was negative. In other words, people were spending more than they were making. Well, after the recession hit, the savings rate now has gone up to 4 or 5%. And, of course, that's good. In other words, simply a reaction to the big crash.
You talked a bit about issues related to super capitalism, issues related to perfectionism,
mm-hmm.
and then something you call a false society. Mm-hmm. How are these related?
They are different tracks in the sense of the super capitalism we just see. Take the hedge funds, for example. They haven't been regulated, and we did away with certain rules that contributed to the Wall Street crash. It's, again, that out-of-control aspect that finally crashes and gets us into trouble. What happens is I think we get caught in such a way, in such an intense way, we get very perfectionistic and driven. We've got to make this go. And you have some success or big money that's more and push. And this drive filters down even to our younger people. And so we're seeing more of an aspect of a real drivenness of perfectionism. And even I mentioned that statement that we sometimes hear, even in politics, I just cringe when I hear it. Failure is not an option.
But is it perfectionism or is it something else? Because if it was really perfectionism, wouldn't the cheating issue not be so prevalent?
No, the perfectionism becomes so driven that you cheat and can't admit to it. The perfectionism is a very rigid position where you also become unaware of the cover-ups and the things. And then the bad part of it is that when you do get caught, you are so exposed and so vulnerable, it can even lead to an abrupt act of self-destruction and a failure. In my paper that I had talked about in the book, you know, I presented it at Quantico to law enforcement personnel because they have always had a high rate of suicide. And I made the connection that, you know, these are perfectionistic people thinking often, you know, very driven and in a right-wrong kind of manner. And when they make a mistake, they can't handle it. It's kind of like the bigger you are, the harder you fall. So the very successful, driven person, success after success, then encounters a failure, and it's like falling off a big cliff, and they can even at that point commit an abrupt act of self-harm.
Can you talk a bit about the media? What do you think the role of media is in creating this false society?
Well, the problem is, you know, to the often heard statement, if it bleeds, it leads. I mean, we know from research that bad is stronger than good, as the researchers put it, that bad events, negative talk about someone, complaints, are remembered and incorporated far more readily than nice things or good things. And just in general, overall, the proliferation of the media, there's this intensity for really negative, bad things, in-your-face things. By the way, I was coming into the office and I had the news on, and there's a car chase thing going on, you know, and I'm sure it's on the TV showing some guy being followed. What's the point of that? We call attention to things like kidnappings and school shootings, and we have a red alert, things on kidnappings. Well, this sounds really good, but on the other hand, it induces such an anxiety and fear level across society that people change their lifestyles. They don't want their kid to go play in the park, or they're going to drive them to school, even though in the actual logic and data of it all is that kidnappings and school shootings have not increased. They're not on the increase and more of a problem than they were before. We're just heightened in anxiety about them. And so I think bad is stronger than good, as I put it, is really impacting us.
So let's wrap this into where you think we should go. Part of your subtitle is Why We Need to Redefine Success. And in your book, you talk about changing from a generation me to a generation we. How do we get there from here?
Well, not easily, and it's not going to happen quickly. These are powerful forces, and it's really going to take a good bit of change in time. It's first, as I mentioned before, the boundaries and regulation. I think we really have to get back to that, both with dealing with young children growing up, but also our culture and environment, too. You know, there's an old saying in family systems therapy, a child cannot develop and grow without limits and boundaries. And, of course, if those boundaries are too tight and rigid, that's not good. If they're too loose, that's not good. So the difficult part is finding that proper middle region. But the same is true of our economy and rapidly developing capitalism, what I've called out-of-control capitalism. There need to be boundaries and regulations in order for it to grow. And we're still resisting that at the cultural and political level, but that would really be essential for coming just down the line and shaping our behavior, because we will respond well to as adequate boundaries and regulations. And then the other part is certainly how we measure success. We're always talking about the GDP. You know, I did look at that group you told me about, Redefining Progress, you know, which has very similar measures for trying to measure success, not by quantity, but by quality. The UN has developed some indices for what's going on in a community, ranging from healthcare to resources and things. And these types of indices should be talked about and presented and discussed much more than simply the amount of things that we buy, which is all that the GDP reflects. I like to ask some people about the GDP, you know, like in 2007, it was awfully high, but how much of that GDP was due to false or bad mortgage loans? If we take that out, then what happens? And then the other thing, I think, is reducing screen media time in terms of, particularly for younger children. The National Academy of Pediatrics talks about less than...
When you say screen media... You
anything
mean
off the screen?
Okay.
You know, I see. We use that broader term now to include not just TV and computers, but even all the phones and texting and all those things. Just reduce that, particularly with younger kids, and really emphasize what a lot of professionals have been putting forth lately: that the younger person, the child, has time for free play, free unstructured play. That is so important for natural creativity. Everything's kind of programmed and given to the child, and they're getting all sorts of things off the screen media rather than having their own free play, creative, unstructured play.
Well, Jay Slosar, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Jay Slosar is the author of The Culture of Excess, How America Lost Self-Control, and Why We Need to Redefine Success. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to Ankina Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin. If you missed a part of the show, you can always go back to kpfk.org, go to the audio archives. You can always podcast us and follow us at scholarcircle.org, armudian.com, and on Twitter at armudian. See you next week.